This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and editors about politics. It's Friday, November 11th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. President Obama met at the White House yesterday with President-elect Donald Trump.
And most of all, I want to emphasize to you, Ms. President-elect, that we now are going to want to do everything we can to help you succeed, because if you succeed, then the country succeeds.
Jill Lepore and Evan Osnos join me to discuss periods of enormous social upheaval in this country and the populist movements behind them. Thank you both for joining me on this historic week.
Hi, Dorothy.
Good to be here.
Jill, let's start by going back to the 19th century, to the greatest crisis in American history. You write in the magazine this week very interestingly about Frederick Douglass, who gave a speech in Philadelphia in 1862, just after the start of the Civil War. He had escaped from slavery less than 25 years earlier and gone on to become the most famous anti-slavery spokesman in the world. What did he have to say then that's pertinent today?
Yeah, you know, I had just come across this speech, and I found it so moving. He called the speech "The Reasons for Our Troubles," and it's just a few months into the fighting of the Civil War. And Douglass, you know, goes through the list of things that people had been attributing the Civil War to, the causes. And they're what, you know, I think have often been taught in American schools. Oh, the radicalism of abolitionists, the perfidy of Southern politicians and their duplicity, and chiefly the election of Abraham Lincoln is what people blame the beginning of the war. And of course, there was an immediate instigation for the war. And Douglass waves all this aside. Let's just look with clarity here. The cause of this war, the reason for our troubles, is slavery. And there's a beautiful image where he says, you know, you hit your shackle to the ankle of one man, but you don't always see until it's too late to see it, as the other end of that chain is shackled around your own neck. And it's a quite, I think, telling image and a compelling way to think about what it means to have a society where forms of grave injustice exist and what the consequences are.
And Evan, I wanted to ask you on the program today, too, because people are having such trouble making sense of this particular moment. You followed Trump throughout the campaign. We know now that he figured out, as none of his opponents did, how to exploit Republican voters' rage on economic insecurity. And that was, again, an insight that Frederick Douglass had, that if there was radical inequality in this country, that we were defying our ideals as a nation, and that there was going to be a massive revolt. Donald Trump kept telling the country he was building a movement. So in your most recent piece for the magazine, you described what a Trump presidency would look like. At the time when we were working on it, it seemed like almost a fanciful thought experiment. But what does it look like now?
Yeah, that story went from being a thought experiment to being something closer to a roadmap for our political predicament. I mean, there's a couple of things that are worth keeping in mind about what the Trump presidency is likely to look like or may look like. People often say, well, how can we know anything about what a Trump presidency will look like because he's changed position so many times? We don't really know what he believes. But actually, he has been consistent on three core ideas. One of them is his belief that the United States is fundamentally worse off because of its connections to the outside world and its contributions to the outside world. He also believes that the United States has been deeply hurt by immigration. And third, he believes that trade has actually impacted the United States. And so he may move around, he sort of bobs and weaves on his policy prescriptions, but on those core ideas, he has remained fairly consistent. And if you look back over the course of presidencies historically, what you find is that candidates actually fulfill a surprisingly large number of their campaign promises. There's a number of studies that have put that figure somewhere between about 70% and 80% that they actually achieve the things that they set out to do, or they make a meaningful effort to try to achieve those things.
I want to just ask you about a specific case, because this is one of the things that people are still trying to make sense of. So let's take Arizona. John McCain ended up winning re-election to the Senate by a solid margin, But on a local level, Latinos helped to unseat Joe Arpaio, who was Maricopa's virulently anti-immigration sheriff. And that was after 23 years in the job. He was defeated by a wide margin. How do we explain this kind of split?
Yeah, Arizona is a fascinating case because on one level, I think it's a pretty stark measure of how much the individual personas on the ticket really mattered here. You know, many of the people I spoke to on Election Day in Virginia, for instance, said they were not so much voting for Trump as they were voting against Clinton. And so that can explain part of the reason, I think, why sort of two unpopular but diametrically different candidates, Joe Arpaio and Hillary Clinton, could both lose. A lot of Democrats and Latino activists had hoped that this year Arizona was going to sort of turn purple, and it did not. It's not entirely clear what happened, though. I think it's possible that a lot of moderate Republicans rallied to John McCain's cause, and at the same time, they did not rally to Hillary Clinton's cause. It's also worth pointing out that John McCain now returns to the Senate. He'll be 80 years old. This is probably his last term, and he stands in a category almost of one in terms of the people who may be able to provide a Republican counterweight to some of Donald Trump's positions. McCain disappointed a lot of people as a candidate when he was running by not disavowing Trump, but he's not probably going to run for office again.
Jill, does this populist uprising feel different from others the country's experienced? We also saw, of course, the Bernie Sanders coalition. He managed to assemble a large group of left-wing voters who were just as disgusted by Washington as Trump voters were, so much so that many of them voted for the third-party candidate, Jill Stein, or refused to vote at all rather than return a Clinton to the White House.
It does feel different. And I think, but one of the things that's so interesting about trying to draw the historical comparison, and this just to sort of circle back to Evan's remarks about Arizona, is what we think we know, we do not know any longer. So even while you could look to the previous accomplishments of earlier presidencies and calculate that they accomplish about 70 to 80% of their campaign agenda while in office, we really don't know that that will apply to Trump. That so much of the conventional wisdom of political science, and not conventional wisdom, but empirically demonstrated findings of political science, have been upended by this election. The number of columns people wrote over the last year about the decline of the Republican Party while completely failing to see that it's the Democratic Party that has been destroyed. So I guess it's hard to look to earlier populist movements, and historians are always reluctant to draw analogies in any case, just because so little of what of the patterns of the past seem to be replicable just now. But I think the most instructive moment to look to, late 19th century populism, it was really kind of largely a coalition of farmers and came from the middle of the country and the western part of the country, was furious and impassioned and had a very serious critique to offer to people that didn't see their suffering, which was so quite similar to this moment when the Industrial Revolution left a lot of people behind. And yet crammed down their throats was a story about progress and the great economic progress of the 19th century. And when populists said, you know, progress has left us out, that was a really important message. But what managed to happen then that was different than what's going on now is that that populism fed into and fueled the progressive movement of the early 20th century, where social scientists and experts decided to try to offer government solutions to the kinds of inequality that industrialism had produced. And that's where actually progressives of our day have fallen down. They haven't done that work. So populists are not looking to policy elites to come up with great solutions to remedy the structural inequalities that our economic systems are producing.
What about that, Evan? We have seen the rise of Occupy. We've seen Black Lives Matter. And there's the potential for these groups to become more powerful now, along with the flip side, the David Dukes of the world.
Yeah, I mean, we are right now in the midst of beginning to see the protests in places like New York and in Chicago, San Francisco, and so on. And the question is whether this is going to be a momentary burst of anger or whether this is going to coalesce into something more substantive and powerful and sort of politically organized. Will it kind of have a galvanizing effect on the left in somewhat the same way that Barack Obama's election contributed to the birth of the Tea Party, which we remember just a couple of years after Obama was elected, it had the Tea Party had sort of helped to lift the GOP into a new congressional majority and became a sort of sustained resistance to the president. It'll take a little while to know. It took a few months, as Jill can tell us. She really knows more than anybody about the origins of the Tea Party, but it took a while before the Tea Party took shape. But I think one element that is important is the degree to which a new progressive populism can distinguish itself from what the Democratic Party is going to do. In a sense, you know, in order to have a sense of purpose and an organizing effect, it will have to feel as if the Democratic Party is not embracing those issues. And if inequality is the issue, as Jill points out, the Democratic Party's inability to be able to express that issue clearly enough in the election could be the organizing impulse for a movement. But I think one of the last pieces that's important to think about also is leadership. I mean, who is going to be the leader of the new progressive populism? Is this the moment where Bernie Sanders returns to prominence? Or what role will Barack Obama play, frankly? But I think you also have this now next generation of Democratic leadership, people like Gavin Newsom in California and, you know, Andrew Cuomo and people like that, none of whom are enormously popular at the moment, but it can be sometimes hard to picture who is going to come into a position of prominence.
Yeah, I mean, I think that in the short term, people are going to be rightly really occupied trying to think about ways to defend against possible political and legal persecution of people who are vulnerable. So I think that's one kind of organizing that people will be doing. The difference between the early Tea Party movement, which really did begin, you know, the day, I think, you know, remember Glenn Beck's Fox News show debuted the day before Obama was inaugurated. And he, in a very visible way, offered a kind of leadership to that movement and really urged it on. And, of course, made Obama's early months in office quite difficult. But a difference there between what you're seeing right now on the streets, these furious protests, is that the Tea Party was making the argument that the Constitution was on their side and that Obama was essentially unconstitutional. And this, of course, is, you know, part of the Trumpism itself. The birtherism was the unconstitutionality of even the election of Barack Obama. And it was really effective for them to embrace that language. And it's not so typical on the left for people to make the claim that that their position is the constitutional one. And yet this is a moment exactly to be doing that, to use as the recourse for every argument the ideals of the Constitution. And that, just to circle back to Frederick Douglass, was what was really important in Douglass's lifetime and was pivotal to the ultimate efficacy of the abolitionist movement. For decades, abolitionists just damned the Constitution, and, you know, William Lloyd Garrison called it a covenant with death and burned it on July 4th, and Douglass realized and had the insight, okay, wait a minute, we actually have to get the Constitution on our side. We have to just say, we have to reject that idea. We have to argue that the Constitution makes slavery impossible, not that it makes it possible. And that turn was what made abolitionism work, and it's what got people like Lincoln on the side of abolitionism. And I guess I hope that instead of, you know, bashing at piñatas that are in the shape of Donald Trump's head on the streets, that people began to think about constitutional arguments that can dismantle possible legislation.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
So what about, say, the Supreme Court decision on gay marriage? There we have something that is now part of our legal system. It shows that grassroots movements can make a difference, that people can get together at the local level and state level. This is what everyone's trying to figure out now. How can some of these movements end up in laws of the land that guarantee the rights that a majority of Americans still apparently believe in?
You know, the movement in the second half of the 20th century down to our time to seek judicial solutions over legislative ones for rights for minorities, beginning with Brown v. Board and right down to same-sex marriage, has been a really complicated one, but it has worked effectively for conservatives to argue that those rights are fragile. It's what allows the gun rights movement to get people to vote. So I wonder if, as terrifying as it is to know that some of those changes are vulnerable to changes on the court, whether from a vantage of popular organizing, it's actually not something of an advantage.
I was struck by a line in Jill's story that is a very powerful point. It was a quote from Douglass where he said, "Right wrongs no man." And the idea, I think, of rights is at a sort of moment of ripeness, in the sense that for the last 8 years, the language of rights and the language of liberty has been at the center of the conservative populist surge. And what we're going to see if Donald Trump proceeds in the presidency in the way that he has indicated as a candidate is that the language of rights is going to become urgently relevant to the left too, whether you're talking about in the Muslim community or in the black community as its relationship to law enforcement or other underrepresented groups. And I think, you know, what we've learned, if anything, is that the sort of most galvanizing force in populist politics today is the sense of deprivation. That's what drove ultimately the Trump coalition together, was the sense that people were being deprived of opportunity and status. And the strangest, and for me at least, the most unsettling thing about this moment right now as we look ahead to the Trump presidency is that the events that will shape it, the events that will shape what we that later look back on in history as the Trump presidency, have not even revealed themselves. You know, we are at the equivalent moment of the very beginning of the George W. Bush administration, or for people who were unnerved by Barack Obama's administration, the very beginning of that. And the events that eventually become so essential, in George W. Bush's case, you know, it was obviously 9/11 and eventually the invasion of Iraq. Those things have not happened yet, and they will become the triggering moments that give force and meaning, I think, to whatever comes of the next generation of progressive activism.
One of the things that's interesting to me and what you're both saying is that progressives can harness traditionally conservative language about the Constitution and about individual rights.
I don't think it's necessarily conservative. I think constitutionalism and constitutional arguments have been predominantly made by conservatives lately, in the same way that the invocation of the American people is generally more often made by conservatives. Liberals tend to want to talk about humanity and cosmopolitanism, and the language of the American people seems parochial sometimes, I think, to some liberals. And as essential as it is to our political discourse, it's actually not used very much by progressives. But I do think, I agree absolutely, that it's an incredibly important opportunity and the most effective set of tools that people who want to contest the possible abuses of a Trump administration is not to declare Trump himself unconstitutional or to make the same moves that are so divisive that opponents of Obama made, but to make careful constitutional arguments and to be willing to engage in what legal scholars call popular constitutionalism, that is to bring constitutional arguments to the people and ask people to reckon with them.
So, Evan, getting back to your piece, you can see already that Republicans are struggling with the question of if invited, they should join the Trump administration. Some continue to say they will not. Others are feeling that you have to go in, that it's your duty as a patriotic American to help this administration organize. What are people saying?
Yeah, this is something that is changing in real time very fast. You know, when I wrote the piece a couple of months ago and was talking to a lot of Republican officials, one of the things that they said at the time was, look, this is somebody I can never support, somebody I'll never work for. There were more than 100 Republican officials, mostly in the national security realm, who said that Donald Trump would be dangerous to the country and they would withhold their support. But there were others who were on the fence. There was one of them who said to me, sort of memorably, he said, "The question is President Trump going to be like Silvio Berlusconi who was a sort of petty tyrant who was ultimately manageable, or would Trump be more like Mussolini? So you heard in that, I think, there was this effort to try to almost find a rationale to be able to join. And sure enough, these days, just in the last couple of days, I'm beginning to hear from people who are saying, look, the dynamics have changed now. This is no longer a political gesture. This is a patriotic act, not to support a candidate, but to support our country at a moment of immense fragility. And, you know, I have to say, just sort of speaking personally, I think they might be right. I was very against the idea of anybody demonstrating support for a Trump candidacy as a, you know, if they were Republican officials. But right now, the possibility that people of goodwill could go into the government, not necessarily the administration, but go into the government and try to have some sort of positive effect is a hard case to argue against.
We haven't mentioned Hillary Clinton at all, the first major party female candidate in history who came very, very close to winning. She won the popular vote by a small margin. And Jill, it struck me when I was thinking about this that one of my favorite Frederick Douglass statements came late in his life. He was a great champion of women's rights, even though he infuriated Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony by pushing for the 15th Amendment without the guarantee for the female vote. And late in his life, I think it was in 1888, he was speaking to a group of women in Washington about the women's rights movement. And he said, "When a great truth gets abroad in the world, no power on earth can imprison it or prescribe its limits or suppress it." So that statement is giving me some solace.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite heartening to think about the journey that Douglass made from fighting against the Constitution to interpreting the Constitution as a document that could emancipate his people to a really broad universal understanding of human rights. And this transformation that a lot of thinkers were making in the 19th century. But that is our intellectual inheritance. That is the ideal that we carry around. I mean, I talk in this piece about a speech Douglass made arguing for Chinese immigrants to be able to have citizenship under the terms of the 15th Amendment, which was an extraordinarily unusual position for anyone to take in 1869 when he gave a speech on that subject. But the capacity to move through a struggle and to see the suffering of others as akin to your own, that's the work that this election needs to allow people to do in order to fight for the ideals that we do all believe in.
Thank you both so much.
Thanks, Dorothy.
Thanks, Dorothy.
Jill Lepore and Evan Osnos are staff writers. Jill is the author of Book of Ages, The Life and Opinions of Jane Franklin. Evan is the author of Age of Ambition, Chasing Fortune, Truth, and Faith in the New China. This has been The Political Scene from The New Yorker. You can find more political analysis and commentary on NewYorker.com or on the New Yorker apps, available at no extra charge from the App Store and Google Play. And you can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app. The Political Scene is produced by Alex Barron and Jill Duboff for NewYorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.